Elise Glink joins us, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. ThinkGlink.com is her website. Hi, Elise. Welcome back.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
Because this is America, I feel compelled to ask you this. Did you watch any of those movies this weekend?
I did not. I thought about going and never quite made it. What about you?
Saw Oppenheimer, and it's swell. I didn't like it as much as a lot of people liked it, but I really liked it. Let's talk about rents. Let's talk about real estate right now. I know you've been following one story in particular. What's this all about?
So the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, NFCC, launched a new sort of initiative called Make It Real. And what they're talking about here is how to address renter insecurity across the country. So we've talked about this, John, about how renters have really gotten the short stick over the last couple of years. Rents have jumped up tremendously. They're now starting to come down, the increases, but people are paying a lot of money for rent. They're typically paying more than the 30% of their gross monthly income that they probably would feel comfortable paying. And there's a lot of renter insecurity going on. So more than half of renters have some kind of personal experience with eviction, for example. And if you're a Black American, 57% have had experience with personal eviction. And that sort of renter insecurity has made people feel very nervous. And so this organization, this not-for-profit organization, is working on ways to help people get their debt organized. So if the worst thing happens, they're able to move on and find another place to rent.
You're not saying that the evictions are unwarranted, are you?
I'm not saying that necessarily, but what we're seeing out in the marketplace is landlords recognizing that they are able to get more rent from somewhere else if they advertise, and so they are encouraging current tenants to leave in some cases. In some cases, tenants just aren't paying the rent, so they get evicted. There's questions about what's actually going on, but sometimes people are getting evicted when they don't need to be evicted, and so the National Foundation for Credit Counseling wants people to help them understand their own rights and opportunities when it comes to eviction and rent.
Well, I don't know about the color line there, although I would imagine people of color are treated differently than maybe white people. But I suppose one way to oust somebody from your dwelling, if you're the landlord, whatever your motivation is to raise the rent so much that person can't afford it. And I don't know if that's being evicted, but you can sure force people out if you just raise the rent. And it sounds like that's happening to a lot of people.
I think that is happening to a lot of people. According to Bloomberg, 8 million rental households are currently behind in their rent. And there are three states where that number is approaching 20%. Louisiana is one, New York, and I'm blanking on the third at the moment. But in the South, in particular, the numbers of Black families who are experiencing housing hardship, meaning that they're just having trouble making their rent payments on time every month, is far in excess of where it is in the rest of the country. And so these numbers are interesting and they're troubling, but I'm really glad that the National Foundation for Credit Counseling is watching it and they're doing something about it.
Right. It sounds like, if I may, what they're doing is advising people to have your house in order, that is, your financial house. But I just wonder if there's any other recourse for those folks. Remember, landlords are people, too. So those are the competing interests here. So there's such a thing as renter insecurity. 50% of folks have faced, what did you call it?
Eviction.
Eviction.
So they have some sort of direct personal experience with eviction. People who are over 35 years old are more likely than people under 35 to blame the tenant in a landlord-tenant issue. And you asked just before the break if there was a place that tenants could go, and almost every major city in the country, including Chicago, has passed a landlord-tenant act. In some cases, it's a state act. In some cases, it's a local city, municipality. And there's a landlord-tenant ombudsman in Chicago and an office that you can go to if you're having questions or concerns about your landlord.
Talk to me about Twitter's getting rid of the little blue and white logo, the bird.
Is it a tweet if there's no bird, John? I don't know.
Keep going. I mean, I don't understand that. I know that it's essentially a new company now that Elon Musk is running it, and there's new rules and new revenue streams. The platform is different. So maybe it's time for a logo change, but maybe not. People don't hate Twitter. They hate Elon Musk. I don't know that the bird is a bad thing.
So Elon Musk owned the website X.com for a really long time. And when he sold his first company, and it got rolled up into what became PayPal, PayPal then owned X.com. And in 2017 or 2019, Elon Musk finally bought back X.com. And he has this company called SpaceX. For Tesla, there's an X model. And for Elon Musk, X marks the spot. So what is he doing by rebranding Twitter and telling us it's going to be the everything app? Well, there is in China an everything app called WeChat, and it's called a super app because it does everything. And I think, I don't know how many people in China use it, but if I said that everybody in China has access to it, that would probably be close to the truth. And they do everything on this. They buy things on it. It's a digital payment app. It's a wallet. You message people. You can promote. There's, public accounts. Businesses have them. There's a direct-to-consumer. There's business-to-business sales. All this stuff happens on WeChat. And it's possible that what Elon is doing, since he likes this website, he said he likes it, that he's trying to fashion Twitter into a super app called X. I don't know. I don't have any inside story on this other than what I've read about what Elon Musk and his new CEO talk about.
But at least that does seem... Facebook was a perfectly fine name, but now we know it's Meta. So maybe if the company has different or broader ambitions, then it's time for some new brand logo. So that's not without precedent. I get that. But X, to me, is also a negative. If you said it's a white and black X, to me, that's stop, don't do, warning, not good. And yet that's and of course, Elon Musk would love it. Blue is a friendly color. It's a bird. It's a plane. I mean, it just strikes me as being not a good move, except that I'll bet he's been itching to use X.com or X, and so now he's got a way to use it.
Yeah, to me, X is like the pirates, and you've got X marks the spot where you're going to go dig up the treasure, and I don't know. But you know what? I guess X.com is easy to remember. He owns it, and he likes the letter. So when you have this much money, John, you are the richest man in the world. Even after you've lit $20 billion on fire, I guess you get to just decide this kind of stuff.
How worried are people about outliving their money?
They're so worried. Right. Everybody except Elon Musk is worried about, outliving their money. And so this year, there's something called a longevity annuity that you can buy. It's called a QLAC, Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract. It's been around for about a dozen years. And what it does is it allows you to take some of your 401k money and you buy an annuity, and it doesn't happen immediate. It doesn't pay you starting today, but you buy it, let's say, at 65, and when you're 75 or 85, the payments start. And so it just allows you to take some money today and put it off into the future. And there's a very significant amount of money that you could get paid out. So, for example, if you're a 65-year-old, and what's new about this is that they're increasing, as of now, the size of the QLAC that you can buy. But a 65-year-old who buys a $200,000 longevity annuity that does not have a death benefit, it starts monthly payouts at 85, would pay them $11,000 a month. So that's a lot. That's $134,000 of payouts in the first year alone, and that would continue until you die. So if you are worried about dying before your money, or running out before you die, you might want to look into this and see if it's right for you.
If you die before the policy goes into effect, then you get your premium back, or the estate does?
That's right. You would get the money back that you had put in originally. They get the use of your money for all those years that you didn't touch it.
Right.
And they get to earn the money off of that. Fair is fair, but you get the money back and it would go to your heirs.
So I guess that's the downside, is that you aren't seeing any appreciation. and they are. So you're loaning this company money that they can invest or do what they do with. And the actuarial tables must indicate to them that enough of us are going to die in time, that that's going to be a good investment for them. But if you do live long enough to use it, how long are you going to use it? And they must figure that the numbers are on their side, huh?
They do, but there's also a benefit to you today, because when that money goes to pay the annuity, it comes out of your 401k, which means your required minimum distributions that have to start at 73 are less, and you pay less in tax. So there is quite a bit of benefit today for people if you can afford it. I mean, the downside is the money's committed and you can't get it back. So if you think you might need that $200,000, that's not going to work for you. But for some people, this is going to be a very good option.
It's called a QLAC. What do those letters stand for again?
Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract, and you should talk to a financial advisor about using one.
That's Elyse Glink, owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves, thinkglink.com. Always interesting, Elyse. Thanks for your help today.
It's a pleasure, John.
Jim Dahlke joins us, national editor at American Inno. Click on ChicagoInno.com to find out more. And let's talk a little bit about Cameo, which was the golden boy of tech startups in Chicago. It's still out there, but they're having to lay some folks off. Huh, Jim?
Hey, John. Yeah, that's right. Some more bad news came last week for Cameo, which, like you said, it was has really kind of been the bright shining star of Chicago's tech scene for several years now, certainly during the pandemic. It was one of those kind of very clear pandemic winners in terms of companies that really took off during 2020. And it makes sense. You know, Cameo is a marketplace for connecting folks, you know, with famous faces. So you can get a video shout out from a famous celebrity, an athlete, entertainer, online internet personality. You know, this was a business that did really, really well as, you know, venues were closed. It was really an avenue one for artists to connect with fans, you know, as most of their gigs were shut down, you know, fan meet and greets were closed. It was really a way for artists to kind of make money and a way for fans to try something fun and different. You know, often as a show goes viral on Netflix, you know, they'll jump on Cameo and people will be able to buy a video message for a friend. And so really it was one of these businesses that did really, really well. They raised $100 million and it got to a $1 billion valuation back in the height of 2021. Fast forward to last week, they just laid off 80 additional employees. So they've had several rounds of layoffs. This is a company that at its peak a few years ago was at about 400 employees. They're down to less than 50 now. Wow. So it's really significant reduction in headcount for Cameo. They're likely, you know, not valued at $1 billion if they were to go out and raise funding again today. So, you know, we're going to see if, you know, Cameo can kind of have a comeback story here as they, you know, resize their headcount. You know, one part of their business that's really interesting is this Cameo for Business. So it's essentially their B2B product. They allow businesses to connect with celebrities for endorsements. And I think that that's kind of interesting, kind of using, you know, famous folks, famous people in different advertising avenues for businesses, whether it's an online advertisement, social media advertisement. I think there's some opportunity there. And it's a business that they were really bullish in, have been really bullish in. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how that piece of their business continues to take off. But, hey, it's going to be a company that has to sort of reimagine itself post-pandemic.
Well, didn't they offer a new service where it would be a live interaction with clients?
Yeah, so they definitely have you know, toyed with a lot of different kind of new business products. One is a live feature, so you can do kind of live Zoom calls essentially with different folks, which is an interesting option. You know, I think that they can, you know, expand into other areas as well. They acquired a company that allowed for different merch sales. So, you know, I think a famous person can also sell merch on the Cameo platform, kind of different merchandise opportunities there. So there's some a couple different areas. Clearly, it's a business that is reeling a bit after their post-pandemic highs.
And one last question about all of that. I mean, is this just the ebb and flow of a business that, like you said, was hot during the pandemic? Is there some flaw here? I mean, what's the future for Cameo?
Well, Cameo, like, you know, many businesses in 2021, especially in the tech startup world, where raising money was very easy to do and it was very easy to grow your business very, very quickly and add a ton of employees. you know, lots of companies did not anticipate seeing quite the drop-off that they did once 2022 rolled around. And so, you know, really the thought here is, you know, where does Cameo go from here? Obviously, they're a much smaller business than they were today. They're probably going to be a bit more focused. So, you know, maybe, you know, expanding outside their kind of core product is maybe not exactly the first thing that's on their radar right now.
Right.
But, you know, I'm hopeful that this is a business that can continue to one day eventually grow. You know, it's important for Chicago to kind of have these big, flashy, successful tech startups because it helps, you know, get people excited about what's happening in Chicago startup scene and attract, you know, more people here and get more, you know, business here, more investment here. And so Cameo's success definitely lifts up the rest of Chicago's tech and startup scene. So I do hope that, you know, they will get on the right track at some point.
Speaking of investing in techs and tech startups, Supply Change Capital, who are they and what are they doing?
Yeah, new venture fund in Chicago. They've been investing for a few years, but just last week announced they've closed their debut fund. So they've raised $40 million in their first fund to invest in food startups. So, you know, you and I have talked often about how, you know, Chicago tends to kind of lean into the things that it does well in terms of the tech and startup world. And Chicago is a food town. Often, you know, a lot of the venture summits are really kind of boost a lot of the food startup and tech companies in town. And Supply Change Capital is looking to do something similar. So, yeah, they've got $40 million to invest in food and food-related startups. They've so far invested about $13 million of that into 15 different early-stage food companies. One is a company called Aqua Cultured Foods. They're making seafood in a lab. We've talked about that startup before. Really interesting new business, kind of making you know, artificial seafood from fungi. So interesting company there. And certainly, hey, $40 million, that's welcome, you know, to much of Chicago. As, you know, venture capital harder to come by, a new fund in town is certainly good news.
Mm, yeah, boy, these cultured meats and fish or foods are just positively intriguing to me. And it doesn't make me lick my chops. It doesn't sound delicious, but maybe it will be. And maybe if it's integrated properly into a meal, you know, it's a stew or something like that, I won't notice, I won't care. But that's a sector that is viable, is growing, right?
That's right. Yeah, Aquaculture Foods, you know, just earlier this year raised $5.5 million in the seed funding round to continue to work to bring their seafood alternatives to market. So a good little haul there. And yeah, I mean, really, at the end of the day, the market will decide, right? Like, you know, you've got to nail the taste. Obviously, there's a sustainability element to this that, you know, that consumers will be interested in. But at the end of the day, food's got to taste right. It's got to be, you know, as similar as you can be to that texture of traditional seafood, but it's also got to taste great.
Mm, yeah. Let's talk about the tech talent that Chicago has right now. You reference that a lot. What's the scorecard show us today?
Yeah, new U.S. tech talent market ranking from CBRE. It doesn't exactly show some good news for Chicago. So Chicago did not crack the top 20 in CBRE's new report of tech workforce demographics in the U.S. and Canada. Chicago came in actually at number 23 among the top 50 markets in the U.S. and Canada, number 17 in the U.S. So they ranged in a bunch, looked at a bunch of different metrics there, you know, depth of the market, vitality, attractiveness for companies. You know, Chicago did have some good showings, though, within the report. Chicago ranked number 9 overall for tech talent, and with its workforce of over 166,000 people. Its local tech workers averaged a salary of $103,000, which is also up about 13.5% from 5 years ago. So there's some bright spots there, but certainly a city the size of Chicago should be performing better than that, certainly within its U.S. rankings. And so I know there's a lot of people in the city that would like to see that that ranking show up a little bit better.
Hmm. Okay, you can read about this and more online. That's Jim Dahlke, National Editor at American Inno. We click on ChicagoInno.com in these parts. Nice to talk to you, Jim. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN Radio. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's CME Group has cut about 100 employees, or 3% of its staff. Wall Street's biggest banks have been chopping positions right and left this year, shedding more than 20,000 people during the first 6 months of 2023. CME is the country's largest derivatives exchange. A spokesperson says some of those cut will be moved to new roles in cloud-focused technology. By all accounts, this past year has been a strong one for CME. Trading was up 19% last year. The CEO described 2022 as the best in CME history. Northern Trust has been knocked down a rung on the list of Chicago's largest banks compiled by Crain's using S&P Global Market Intelligence. BMO Bank is the new top bank with $177 billion in assets. That's a 6% increase for BMO from 2021 to 2022. At second, Northern Trust has assets of $154 billion, a 16% drop during the same time period. Several of Chicago's biggest banks saw a big drop in assets. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's a business of food update with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. It's been quite a year for Chicago restaurant legend Phil Stefani. Actually, it's been quite a career. How long, Phil?
43 years.
More from him after I thank the Chevy Silverado HD for picking up the check. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, Phil Stefani.
So it started back in 1980 at Fullerton and Southport with our first restaurant called Stefani's.
And a half dozen restaurants later.
25 years ago, we opened up Tavern on Rush.
But when that lease expired at the end of last year, Tavern went away because the landlords had other plans.
And everybody says, why are you leaving? Well, very simple. I don't have the title to the building.
But
here's the thing. You know, I've been at that Rush and Bellevue corner for 25 years. So I wanted to be there.
And he found a spot right across Bellevue from where Tavern was.
It took a long time to negotiate this deal.
So after many months of construction and prep, the new restaurant at Rush and Bellevue is scheduled to open in the spring.
Springtime is really when you want to open.
And no sense in opening in January in Chicago, although the new place will have a patio.
You need a patio. It's crucial.
And there are some very hardy diners among us.
Yeah, back in the days at Tavern, people sat out there and pretty cold weather.
But the new restaurant may not be the rebirth of Tavern on Rush. Other names are being considered.
We need to decide our concept for the space, and then we'll decide what the brand is.
Long before all of that, Phil Stefani has another opening. For years, he has made pasta for all his restaurants at a facility on Hubbard.
We also sell it to other, you know, some stores and restaurants.
But that business has moved to Norwood Park, and in a few weeks, it'll open as Luigi Stefani Pasta.
Luigi was my dad.
Who came to the U.S. from Italy after World War II, and Luigi's will not only manufacture pasta.
People can also eat it there.
Lots going on for Phil Stefani and his team.
As much as I get all the credit, without staff, you don't fly the airplane. It's a very difficult business.
And will Tavern on Rush be returning? Stay tuned. From the farm to your belly, today's National Tequila Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Emily Kenmore joins us again. We always like to point out when there's groups coming to Chicago, sometimes it's thousands of people, sometimes it's dozens. The Hands of Peace site director and program alum is part of the Hands of Peace organization. They bring American, Israeli, and Palestinian teens together every July. They do this in San Diego and Chicago. They try to make them agents of change and peace in their communities. That's ambitious. Emily, welcome back. You're on the air. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you? Thank you so much for having us.
So is this a camp? Is this just talk to me about how you do what you do.
Yeah, so we're a three-week summer program. We do kind of a combination of classic, I guess, summer camp activities. We go to a ropes course. We go on different field trips. But the big bulk of our three-week summer program is actually centered around dialogue. So our Israeli, Palestinian, and American participants engage in 2.5 hours of dialogue each day during these 3 weeks. Discussing the conflict in Israel and Palestine, current events in the United States, really creating, you know, skills to become those agents of change we're looking for.
These kids are in Chicago now?
They are, yeah. We have 36 participants in Chicago, 38 in San Diego. We have 10 Israeli, 10 Palestinian, 6 who are Palestinians that actually live within Israel, and then 10 Americans. Most of them are local to the Chicago area.
How old are these kids on average?
Yeah, so they're all in high school. Average age is 15 to 18 years old.
Are they necessarily in opposition to each other based on their family or national or political thinking?
Well, and that's what all comes out in dialogue. We recruit and try to recruit, you know, the most diverse group of participants possible in order to create really interesting conversations within our dialogue groups. So we don't necessarily encourage them to always agree on everything. That's what's, you know, the beauty of dialogue is we have trained facilitators that guide them through discussions. And even if they do disagree, they kind of learn how to listen and then respond in kind of respectful ways to kind of, you know, see the other side, step into each other's shoes. And that's kind of the beauty of this program.
So you're not trying to persuade anybody about anything particularly then?
No persuading there. It's we're basically providing them a platform that they don't normally get back home, where one, they're able to actually connect with one another, meet each other face to face for many of them the first time. Mm-hmm. But then also providing a platform where they can discuss really important issues and social topics that, as youth, maybe, you know, their adult counterparts might not be listening to them, or they just, you know, get it empowered enough to pursue peace building and gain the skills to do so.
It's interesting to me that you ask Americans to be there. I don't know if these are Jewish Americans or Palestinian Americans, but what sort of things do you suggest or prompt the kids to talk about?
Yeah, so our American delegation, it's about 50-50 local to the Chicago area Americans, and then we do actually get American high school students from other states. And really, they come from various backgrounds. Some might be Jewish or Muslim, Catholic. Some might just be interested in international relations, Model UN, anything like that. Some might actually have family within Israel or Palestine. So they all kind of come with their own reasoning why they want to be here. They do go through orientation sessions. So we kind of prep them a little bit with kind of some of the terms or important dates within the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But really part of the dialogue process is they start off on that first day making a list of all the, you know, hot topics that they want to discuss as a group, so that the facilitators can kind of help them through those different topics.
But you're not asking them.
Guided by the participants.
Sure, but you're not asking them what their favorite movie is or who their favorite band is. You're diving right into the topics of the day, and it would just seem to me like there's such historic hostility between, say, the Palestinians and the Israelis that it would strike me as being a difficult task. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is very difficult. They're high school students. They are full of emotion, and it is an emotional topic. We have chaperones who are trained in, you know, if any of the participants is having a difficult time within dialogue and have to leave for any reason, they're kind of trained to help take care of kind of their emotional needs, bring them back into the dialogue space. It is interesting. There's definitely a lot, if anybody's keeping up with the news, a lot going on in Israel and Palestine right now.
Yeah.
And it really is coming up in dialogue with our participants. And a lot of them, again, when they're home, they might not feel comfortable discussing these things or even able to discuss these things with the other side. And so to be able to come to the U.S. and actually have a space where they can discuss these topics, in a respectful way.
You would ask them, for instance, what do you feel would be, I presume there's some prompting or news educating, but how should Israel construct its Supreme Court, or should they rein in some of the court's powers? Is that something that they would be talking about?
Yeah, that's something they would definitely bring up in dialogue. We actually, tonight, we have culture night, so our participants are actually right now in the middle cooking dishes from their own different cultures, but they also have the opportunity to create skits. And these skits can discuss anything from cultural practices, singing, dancing, but then also kind of political topics that they want the other delegations to understand. So I know that's definitely a topic that's going to pop up tonight, is the current court decision in Israel. But yeah, I mean, we provide the space for them to do that.
Emily Kenward is the Hands of Peace Chicago site director. So a few dozen kids from around the country and world are here learning, if nothing else, the art of peaceful dialogue, of civility, of negotiation. Amen to that. You should do one with Republicans and Democrats in the United States.
I know. There's definitely a need for that as well. So, yeah, again, these skills are very universal, which is why, you know, with the American delegation, they might not necessarily continue to pursue, you know, peace in Israel or Palestine, but they might have other social justice topics they're, you know, passionate about. So the skills we give them here could be transferable into other arenas as well.
Handsofpeace.org is the website, handsofpeace.org. Emily, well done. Our best to everyone. Thanks for the update.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Emily Kenward with Hands of Peace. She's the site director here in Chicago. If you want to make a donation, if you want to find out more, handsofpeace.org.